This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading in case I got bored.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Literary Treks, Literary Treks 220, in which we're going to be talking about the William Shatner novel Captain's Blood. But it's not just me talking about this novel by myself, because that would be really boring. So joining me, as he does always, is the wonderful partner in crime, Bruce Gibson. Bruce, how are you today?
I'm doing well. I kind of like the idea of maybe you just talking about the book. I want to see how that would go. It would almost be like your YouTube videos. It's just you doing the talking. So why don't you review Captain's Blood and I'll just sit here and laugh. I'll be your laugh track.
Yeah, I'm going to veto that. I really like the discussion aspect a bit too much. So it would be just me doing me and then another voice. And it would just get really weird and I'd get confused and wouldn't remember who I was supposed to be at that
That's
moment.
True.
So let's just
I was hoping
that.
You'd say that. I was because I was really sitting here afraid you would say, yeah, I'd prefer just to talk about it by myself and you can just listen. I'd be like, Dan, you don't like me.
Yeah, maybe actually it's a good idea. You shouldn't give me an opening like that. You never know. You never know what I'll say.
I'm testing you.
But no, it wouldn't be Literary Treks without the two of us talking together about something. And not just Captain's Blood, we've got a couple news items. Of course, the newest Star Trek novel release, and this is something that we should focus on because there are precious few of them this year. The newest Star Trek Discovery novel, Drastic Measures, has just been released at the time of this recording. It'll have been out for a little while once this show is released to the public. But if you haven't picked up your copy, you should make sure to grab it because we will, of course, be discussing the book on an upcoming episode. It was released on February 5th, the book was, and Dayton Ward, the author, will, as usual, be joining us to talk about it in episode 222 of Literary Treks. So you'll want to keep an ear out for that. And make sure to pick up this book because, by all accounts, I haven't read it yet myself, but by all accounts from people whose opinions I trust, it's pretty good.
I think Dayton would say it's a good book because...
Yeah, I think so too, yeah.
I think, yeah, because he wrote it. now, I haven't started reading it yet. I do have it. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting into it because, as you mentioned, of course, as of this recording or as this show is released, Discovery has ended its first season. So we don't have any new Star Trek Discovery until the second season comes out, which apparently is sometime in 2019. So we have a year, maybe more, I don't know, about a year until we get new episodes. So now that we're done for season one, it's great to go into an original story through a novel. And then we've got another one after this coming in sometime. I can't remember when, but somewhere later in 2018.
Well, and especially with that jaw-dropping cliffhanger and or everything being wrapped up in a nice little bow that happened at the end of Discovery. Remember, Bruce?
I remember that too, Dan.
I am, of course, kidding. As of the recording of this, we're still a few days away from the season finale of Discovery. So, yeah, who knows what's going to happen? I mean, I guess you guys probably all know, but right now we don't. So,
yes, but as you're listening to this, we do know, even though we don't know.
That's true.
Oh, my.
You know, well, what else I know, Bruce? I know that we have a new comic to talk about this week as well.
Yes, we do. And it's a New Visions comic.
Yeah. So those of you, you know, we've talked about every issue of this series as it's come out. New Visions is the series by John Byrne that is designed to look like a photo novel. He's taken still shots of the crew and the ship from various episodes of Star Trek and put them together almost as a new episode, and sometimes creating his own new backgrounds for and new aliens to populate the story. So this issue is issue number 20. So we've had 20 issues of this series, and this one is called Isolation. So Bruce, initially, what were your thoughts going into this one?
My thoughts were, I hope I like this. I didn't really have any thoughts about it going into it, just wondering, you know, if it was going to be any good or not, because I typically don't read the teasers from the previous issue, because I don't really want to know, I don't want to be spoiled. But in the cover of this, we do see Kirk on the bridge with Spock and McCoy, and Kirk's like, don't you see her? It's Edith Keeler. And Spock's like, but Edith Keeler is dead. And that's all I knew about this issue. What about you?
Yeah, I actually did glance at the teaser in the last issue, so I knew that was coming. But interestingly enough, that situation on the bridge with Kirk and Spock and McCoy and Edith Keeler, that never actually happens in the comic. Edith Keeler does show up, but Kirk sees her as kind of an illusion that only he himself sees while he's separated from everyone else. So the other characters aren't there. So it was a little odd, but I guess kind of in the tradition of we recently talked about the Gold Key comics, right? And they always have that splash page at the front that has some crazy situation. And it may or may not bear some semblance to something that actually happens in the story.
I was just thinking that exact same thing. I was going to bring that up and also mention, you know, never judge a book by its cover.
Or even a few pages in, apparently. That too. But yeah, so this is a really interesting story. We get this, basically something happens. The systems on the Enterprise are kind of going a little weird. And all of a sudden, each of the characters finds themselves completely alone on the Enterprise. And this is kind of illustrated in a really cool image, which is, you know, kind of the second page of the story. And it shows the same scene on the bridge repeated a bunch of times. And each character is just in isolation by themselves with no one else in the panel, which is really neat. So simultaneously, they're all experiencing this empty bridge and basically can't see the people around them or are maybe transported somewhere else or something. We don't really know at this point.
I liked it because, as you mentioned on this page, we're seeing several panels of the bridge, and Kirk's in the top panel by himself, then Spock's in the bottom panel, and McCoy and so on and so forth. But it's the same shot, wide shot of the bridge, and it's repeated throughout the page. And I like just seeing the bridge in a wide shot that's empty. I don't know what it is, but it's like, you know, usually there's people everywhere and something's going on, but just to just look at the empty bridge in this wide shot is just something I enjoy seeing. So I'm kind of glad they disappeared.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. It's visually a really cool thing. I don't know. It just, there's something about it that I feel like would be difficult to get across on a television screen exactly what's happening, because you'd have camera movement and camera changes and stuff. It'd be hard to communicate the idea that every single one of them is alone on the bridge without doing this really wide shot, which you never really saw on the original series with a couple of exceptions.
And that's part of the reason why I like this. Just seeing that shot like that. And notice, I just noticed that there's a red alert going on, but they didn't sound red alert.
Oh, continuity error. Well, basically, we come to understand that there's some sort of being behind this, and he's kind of performing experiments, but it takes a little while for us to get there. Each of the characters, actually, this was another thing I really liked about this comic. Each of the characters responds to this situation in a very unique way. Kirk tries to get off the bridge, tries to hail his crew, tries to get, you know, work the turbo lift. And this part's really cool because we get to see some areas, you know, the guts of the ship that we don't normally see. John Byrne's kind of done a neat job of putting together this kind of hidden behind the walls of the bridge stuff. And Spock, of course, is very logical about it. Starts, you know, doing all these steps to establish exactly what's going on, and, you know, kind of ends up doing the same thing, crawls into the guts of the ship and gets to a different deck. And they're basically, all of the characters are responding to this in their own way, and little different things happen to each one of them.
I like how you said that we see different areas of the ship we haven't seen before, because, again, like seeing the bridge, this is another one of the things that I loved about this comic, is it felt like a tour of the Enterprise. Each character is going to different areas of the ship, some familiar, some not so familiar. But as I'm going through each of the pages, I was really enjoying the fact of, ooh, we're going here and we're going there and we're seeing this and we're seeing that. And there wasn't a whole lot of dialogue. So you're seeing a lot of, you know, full pictures of these different locales on the Enterprise. And I really enjoyed that. I think visually, this is the most I've enjoyed a New Visions comic.
Yeah, I think so too. And for me, it was, you know, the other comics kind of got across what they were trying to show despite the limitations of this. But I think this is the first one that for me really uses this format really well and really explores it, like we said, with the bridge shots earlier. But then, you know, little things like, you know, I didn't know that if you popped the dedication plaque of the Enterprise off the wall, there's a little manual opener for the turbo lift doors there. But Scotty obviously knows that, and that's how he's gonna get into the turbo lift. Those, you know, really cool little things like that were just really neat that John Byrne's able to explore this space that we've seen hundreds of times. Well, 79 times, but then hundreds of more times when we've rewatched them, and is able to do new and interesting things.
I even like Scotty in the engine room, and he's climbing up a ladder to get into his office. And then we're seeing, you know, a shot of him in his office through the window, you know, being, you know, higher up over the engineering room. Just different angles and different things that we haven't seen in the original series. And just like you said, behind the plaque of the operating the turbo lift. And I feel like there was something else I saw in there, too, that was different. But I can't recall what it is at this moment. But I know what it was. When Spock crawls up into, I don't even know what it is, but it's the main library computer.
The computer core.
And it's just like just tons of these recording. I don't even know how to describe it, but like shelves, I guess, of all these different recordings and such. And it's very colorful. It keeps in the same color scheme as the Enterprise, with red and green lights and yellow of the ladder and so. I mean, it's just really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting bits for sure. And I think it's kind of hard to tell, but I think Kirk kicks the panel beside the turbo lift and it opens a door into a different, like there's a bunch of stuff that, because of also a little bit of the limitations of the format here, it's a little hard to figure out exactly what's going on in some of these, but I really appreciate the effort and I think it looks really cool.
Yeah. When Scotty got on the turbo lift, I was a little unsure at first, really what happened to him. Like, you know, he just all of a sudden was on there and then he seemed like he was tumbling out or something, but I guess it was the gravity.
Yeah. Either the gravity or the turbolift dropped really fast or something like that. It's kind of hard to tell exactly what happened.
It probably dropped real fast. Yeah, I'm not really sure. And then also seeing Rand was interesting because she's in a blue uniform and her hair is a different style. And it just shows the progression of time in the 5-year mission and that she's doing a different job. She's got a slightly different look as if, you know, time has moved on from what we saw in the first season.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Spock runs into Rand and doesn't believe that she's real. And Kirk runs into, as we were teased at the beginning of the story, Edith Keeler, who is trying to convince Kirk that, you know, she's asking him, where are we? What is this place? What's going on? Why are you dressed like Dr. McCoy? And he says, what are you talking about? So when Dr. McCoy first came to the mission, he wore a uniform like that. It was a different color, though. And so whoever's behind this has very intimate knowledge or is able to read the thoughts of the crew members and pull very specific things from their minds, because this is a really elaborate deception that's being perpetrated here. And we do learn, of course, it is a deception. It turns out, and I thought this was really interesting, and it took a little bit for me to kind of wrap my head around exactly what happened here, but it turns out they're all exactly where they were on the bridge. And this is all happening in each of their minds, which was a neat concept.
Yeah. So
very Star Trek-y, because I feel like that's something familiar.
Yeah. They're all just frozen on the bridge. And of course, if anybody's going to figure this out, it's Spock. And then he's unfrozen and then he's able to kind of help the others. I'm trying not to spoil it too much, but, you know, of course, you know, Spock helps things to get to where they need to be. But then we see other things where when the crew is isolated, then they start running into each other. Like Chekhov runs into Uhura in her cabin.
But then that turns out to not be the real Uhura. And the real Uhura is being shown what's happening with Chekhov and the fake Uhura. Like there's some really interesting bits. And, you know, this guy that's behind it all, I guess he's experimenting and doing all these weird behavioral experiments on the Enterprise crew. It's different.
And this fake Uhura starts hitting on Chekhov and she's like, it reminds me of Star Trek V with Scotty, too, by the way. But she's like, there are so many more interesting things we could be doing. And Chekhov says, Nyota, Lieutenant, this is not the time. And I'm thinking, it's not the time, Chekhov? Like, what, you think there's a better time for this? Should the answer be like, no, we should be doing this?
Well, luckily, Chekhov does kind of say that next, because, like we mentioned, Uhura is watching this and she's not worried, right? She says, Chekhov will figure it out. He's a smart guy. I don't think that anything, you know, improprietous is going to happen here. And I don't think that's a real word, but, you know, basically Chekhov does say, no, this is wrong. You can't be Uhura. This is not how you act. So,
And now that we're picking on Chekhov, well, we're not really picking on, but I'm going to pick on Chekhov. We have talked about in these New Vision comics, the way Chekhov's dialogue is written. It's a little heavy on the dis and that and all this. There was one panel later on in the story where it was so overdone. I couldn't believe it. I'm looking for it right now. Okay, here we go. He says, confirming dot Kipton, we are half a light year from Beta Reticuli, which is where we were when the equipment started acting up. There are so many v-v-v-v-v-v-s.
Oh, man. You know, honestly, less is more. You know, with something like this, with a speech affectation, you know, just maybe look at a sentence like that and then take out every other instance of, you know, just less is more. Like, we don't need it to be. Yeah, that's too much. I remember that line too, actually. And that's, yeah, it's ridiculous.
But it's sure fun to read out loud.
Yeah, that's true. Well, yeah, so basically, of course, they're all in their own minds and they're getting experimented on. And, you know, we won't reveal exactly how this all wraps up. I think this is definitely, if you haven't read the New Visions comics before, you should pick this one up. This one's a really good example. I think maybe the design of the alien is a little weird and out there, but at the same time, you know, that's kind of one of its saving graces, too. Yeah. I think the fact that you can have something that's a little bit outside of the humanoid norm if you're doing something that's not beholden to what happened on the television show. Yeah, why not take that opportunity?
I can't place what the alien reminds me of, but I keep thinking Dr. Seuss character. But I don't think that's really what...
That could be.
There's something about the alien where I'm like, oh yeah, that reminds me of, and I can't place it. But yeah, to me, it's kind of very Dr. Seuss-y. I don't know if Dr. Seuss-y. Mm-hmm. Have you ever called anything Dr. Seuss-y before? No.
In the Seussian style. What's interesting about the design of the alien, though, I should say, is as soon as I saw him, I heard his voice, which is interesting. Like, he all of a sudden had this very distinctive, kind of soft-spoken, gentlemanly voice with just a little bit of a, I don't know how to explain it, but you know, it's just one of those looks that I was like, oh, I can hear the guy doing this voice now. You know, so I don't know, there's something there that like, oh, that they hit on something that triggered something in my brain anyway that made me kind of capture the essence of this character in my head.
I think that's probably the right call on the characterization of him and how he would speak, you know. And it's almost as if they Photoshop a real face and just kind of morph it and color it to fit. So I just kind of imagine, you know, are they sitting like in an office and say, hey, John, come over here. I want to take your picture. I don't mean John Burns like the author, but like whoever, you know, it's like, Frank, come over here. I want to take your picture. Or do they go to their next door neighbor that they don't like and take his picture and then put him in a comic and morph his face and color it blue or something?
I'm going to say that's probably exactly what happens, Bruce.
I want my face in here. You can color me and distort my face anywhere you want. I think it would be cool to see my face in New Visions.
Oh, that'd be interesting. So what are your kind of final thoughts on New Visions number 20?
The story was fun. I mean, and interesting. I think I kind of knew, in a sense, where it was going, so it wasn't too surprising. But I just enjoyed, like I said, going around the ship and seeing the ship and seeing Rand in a different uniform, seeing other aspects of the ship that we've never seen before. I would say I probably enjoyed this New Visions more than any that I've read before. So it's my favorite New Visions comic.
I think I would have to agree with you on that one. This was a really enjoyable outing for the New Visions comic style. And I think partially because it all takes place on the Enterprise, it's, you know, there's not a lot of challenging environments. But what new environments we do get, like the, you know, behind the walls of the bridge and inside the guts of where the turbo lifts go and the library computer banks, those are really well done and look really realistic. And like they would fit right in with the original series. You know, if there was an episode unproduced that used those sets that surfaced today, we'd be like, oh, yeah, that's what that would look like. So I think John Byrne has done a really good job with this one. And even though the design of the alien popped me out of the story a little bit, it's still a really interesting design. And I think he's done a really good job.
It's not an alien that you would see on the original series.
No, definitely not. But then they all just looked like humans.
So true. So when I read these comics, sometimes I think of when Scott Mance was on the show, we were talking about the photo novels. He said when he reads New Visions, he recognizes like on almost every panel, oh, that shot of Kirk is from this episode. And that's what, do you try to pick those things out when you read them?
Absolutely. And I think kind of at this point, it's not even something that I'm trying to do. It just, like it seems to happen automatically. There were a lot in this one actually that seemed quite, I don't want to say generic, but were a little harder to place because there was a lot of just kind of roaming around the corridors and stuff, but still a lot of very distinctive moments. Like when Kirk's pounding on the turbo lift door, for example, is a very iconic moment. And I know I'm contradicting myself now because I can't remember exactly what episode it's from, but I can totally picture it in my head when he did that.
Yeah, I think it's just amazing that John Byrne is able to go and just pull all these out. I just wonder how long it takes him to do all this.
That would be interesting. I wonder how easy it is to get in contact with
him. I'm sure he's listening right now. John, give us a call.
Excellent. We'd love to have you on. Well, what do you say we leave the world of comics behind us and venture into the Shatnerverse once again?
Sounds good to me.
Well, today in the feature, we're discussing the second book in the Shatnerverse Totality Trilogy, and that is Captain's Blood, written, of course, by William Shatner with Judith and Garfield Reeves Stevens. So, first of all, kind of almost a tradition, when we do these older novels. Bruce, is this your first time reading this one? And how did you read it?
Yes and no. It's my first time reading it, but when it came out, I listened to it as an audiobook, which those are abridged. So this is my first full experience in Captain's Blood by William Shatner. Okay. And I read it as an ebook this time.
Okay. Yeah, this was my first time reading it. But I have owned this one for quite a while. And again, this is one of the ones that it looks like I picked up at a secondhand bookstore while I was living in Korea, because it actually had the original sales receipt inside it. And it was about 8,000 won to buy that book, which is about $8 or so. So.
Oh, well, that's so Wong.
Yeah.
So yeah, the novel came out in 2002 as a hardcover book, and this is the second novel in the Totality Trilogy. Then the third book, which we covered Captain's Peril a few episodes ago, and then sometime here in the next month we're going to do the last one, Captain's Glory, which I also, that one, so Captain's Peril and Captain's Blood, I listened to his audiobooks, but Captain's Glory, I read the hardcover book, which I still have, because I can't part with my Star Trek novels.
I hear you. I'm the same way. I have so many of them, and I have nowhere to put them, but I can't get rid of them. So, and I keep adding new ones, too, which is probably doubly crazy. But yeah, so this one, like you said, it's the second novel in this trilogy. And the first novel, Captain's Peril. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about this, because that one really didn't feel like it had anything to do with this one, with a few exceptions. And first of all, we've got this totality threat that becomes apparent through the course of this novel. And the only thing that really ties that to the last novel is that's the story that Kirk happened to tell Picard while they were vacationing on Bajor, which seems like a really crazy coincidence to me. And the actual story in that book that takes place in the 24th century has really nothing to do with what's going on in this book. I was really expecting some sort of connective tissue. I know you had said that they it feels very standalone, but I thought there'd be like some plot involving the Cardassian that was in the first one, or something to do with Bajor, anything, but none of that. There's absolutely no connection other than while all that was happening, Kirk was telling Picard this story about what happened to him, you know, a century and a half ago.
Yeah. It's so interesting, our perspectives of this, because you hadn't read these books before. And I have when they first came out, and you know, there was some distance between them, of course, when, you know, they were published. And I remember my memory of it at the time was this was a trilogy that just didn't seem to be connected, like you were just saying. So when we read Captain's Peril this time, and now reading Captain's Blood, as I was reading Captain's Blood, I was like, oh, well, now I am seeing how these are connected. It doesn't feel like it's one continuous story over three books, but like you said, Kirk tells a story from his original five-year mission in Captain's Peril, which the villain, in quotes, from that story shows up now in this story. And it's like you said, what is the coincidence that Kirk tells that story and then that person from that story from 100-some years ago shows up?
It's a good thing he didn't tell a story about the Doomsday Machine or Gary Mitchell or something. It could have been really bad.
Yeah, they just all of a sudden, why is the Doomsday Machine here? I was just talking about it.
Yeah, so that strikes me as really odd. But, I mean, you know, I guess it's not necessarily a coincidence. It's just what the writers wrote.
I guess so. We weren't, if you haven't heard the episode of Captain's Peril, we weren't big fans of that one. Let's just say that. And I do have to correct myself. This book came out in 2003, where Captain's Peril came out in 2002. Yeah. But I think Captain's Glory came out in 2006. There's a bigger gap there. So.
Oh, wow.
I think
so. There's a bit of a gap. Yeah, interesting. Well, this one kind of kicks off with Spock on Romulus, and he's giving a speech in front of a crowd of about 3,000 Romulans, and there's an explosion, and Spock is apparently killed with, you know, all these witnesses. But however, we find out very early on that he faked his death to remove himself from the public stage because he felt it was time to leave public life in a dramatic way and to enhance his message, to make it resonate more because of the emotionalism that it would be tied to because of his death. What do you think of this plan? Does this seem logical to you? Does this seem like something Spock would do, or?
Maybe in a Gold Key comic. No. it's not too far off for me. It didn't bother me. It seemed almost kind of like a magic trick that he was pulling, you know, where something explodes, but he falls back and has it planned so he can kind of disappear or something. And I guess I like the idea of him trying to approach things differently to get the Romulans to think differently about things. And I don't know. It did seem a little odd, but of course we know he's not dead.
Yeah. And that's something that I really want to point out is one of the things that really bugged me in Captain's Peril was we spend like a good, probably half of the book with the book almost seemingly trying to convince us that Picard is dead and Kirk mourning Picard and like, oh my God, Picard is dead. And it felt like they were trying to convince the readers of that too, where we know like, no, he's not dead. He can't be dead. Like that's ridiculous. This one takes a very different approach where, you know, it starts off with this event and it says Spock is dead. But then very shortly thereafter in the book, it's revealed to the readers, no, he's not dead. He's alive. You know, it's either the next chapter or the chapter after that. You learn very quickly, which I thought was really good. You know, we still get to experience Kirk's grief because he believes that Spock is dead, but we as the readers aren't being fooled or, you know, not being fooled as the case may be, which I thought was a much better way to do it.
Yeah. And the fact that Captain's Peril made it seem like you said, it's trying to convince you that, you know, Picard may be dead. I don't know if that was the authors trying to convince us, because let's go back to 2002. We don't have Nemesis yet when this book was being written. So maybe the thought was, oh, well, you know, the show's over, so Kirk could be dead. And maybe they thought they could convince people that they're killing off, I mean, that Picard is dead, that they're killing Picard off in the books. But now this book, Captain's Peril, was published October 2002, 2 months before Nemesis. So promotion of Nemesis would be coming out showing that Picard is alive. So anyway, yeah, it didn't bother me that much in Peril because we knew that he would be alive. But Kirk doesn't know he's alive. So we're going on Kirk's journey through that. Where this one, I'm glad that they didn't do the same thing again where we're going to kill off a major character that you know probably isn't dead. And it's like, okay, this time we're not going to downplay it. We're actually going to show you how he faked his death or tell you about it without you waiting to the end when Kirk finds out.
Yeah, I was really worried, I have to admit, when the book opened like that. And I thought, oh, my God, are they going to be trying to convince us the entire book? Because I could totally see a draft of this book being written where the reveal isn't until the very end, you know, kind of giving stuff away. But I mean, not really. Kirk's obviously going to find out that Spock is still alive. And when that reveal happens towards the end of the book, can you imagine if that's when it was revealed to the reader? Like, oh, I would have been so annoyed that they did the exact same thing. But they didn't. They did something different, which I thought was much more interesting.
And I found it interesting also that once that was revealed, because that's how this book starts off, and shortly after that, it's revealed as to what Spock did. I expected Spock to appear earlier in the book then, but he didn't show up till much later. So I thought it was interesting that they revealed that, but yet kept him off the story for like a good half of the book or so.
Yeah, that's true too. It made me wonder throughout the story, where's Spock? Like, where is he in all this? What's his role in this, in what's going on? And like usual, the first part of this will do mostly spoiler free, but we'll get into the spoilers kind of in the last half of the podcast. So, you know, if you haven't read this book yet, you can listen all the way through if you want to be spoiled, but we'll give you a fair warning that we're going to start talking about kind of the last half and the end of this book and what's revealed in it as we get there. So, yeah, I found myself wondering throughout, when is Spock going to show up and what is his role in all of this?
And I thought he was going to show up at the very end. I couldn't, it's been years since I read the book, so I don't remember a lot, but I kept thinking, oh, we haven't seen Spock in a while. Oh, I bet they save him for the very end, and that carries over to the next book.
Yeah, and that makes sense for sure. And I do have to say, I liked Kirk's emotional journey with this. And I love the moments when he's with McCoy and there's this almost unspoken communication. Well, it is unspoken communication between them where Kirk starts thinking about Spock and McCoy pipes up. Yeah, Jim, I miss him too, kind of thing. It's just this bond that the three of those men have is really great. And what they've set up in this book gives the opportunity to the authors to explore what that loss would be like for Kirk, even though we know that Spock isn't really dead and it'll get reversed later, but to be with Kirk on that journey and not be annoyed that they're trying to pull one over on us or something, I thought was really
good. And Kirk is now going on a mission. He's not a Starfleet officer anymore, but he's going on a mission to find, you know, who murdered Spock and also why. But there was a sense that I got from this that I wasn't convinced that Kirk was convinced that Spock was dead.
Oh, interesting.
I just felt he would have been maybe a little more emotional or wanting to I felt like he would be even more determined to find out who the murderer is if he felt Spock truly was dead. Or I can look at it this way, is they've been through so much, they're so old at this point, that they're just of the, you know, we knew this day was coming, and, you know, just kind of accepting it.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's kind of a midpoint between those two that I felt Kirk was at in this story, where, like, it was kind of those quieter, melancholy moments where I felt there was a bit of that, like, it was bound to happen one of these days, but man, I miss that guy. And Bones is like, yeah, me too, Jim. And I don't know. It's just those quiet moments of remembrance.
Yeah, and now that I think about it, they may not be as close as they used to. Not to say that they're not close, but when they're serving on a starship together, they're seeing each other every day and going through everything imaginable that people could go through out in space on these missions. And now they've been separated for many decades, and Kirk is back, and he's occasionally seen Spock, but not on a regular basis. Spock has been busy on Romulus through the unification, and Kirk's been going on other adventures with Picard, like skydiving and telling stories in the desert.
And pulling Picard out of big fish.
Yeah.
And stuff
but no,
like
when
that.
You think about it in these books, it's actually Kirk spends more time with Picard. They seem to have more mm-hmm. of a relationship at this point than Kirk does with Spock.
No, that's true. I never thought of that. So yeah, like you said, they're going on this mission, and basically Starfleet provides them what they call a Q-ship, which is kind of a spy ship almost. It's looks run down and nondescript and old and clunky, but it's actually outfitted with, you know, state-of-the-art technology, really amazingly fast warp engines, and a distributed phaser system that can hide itself, and when it comes online, it assembles and fires or something like that. You know, it's kind of a James Bond ship that's made to look like an old rust bucket kind of thing. And they're taking this ship to Romulus to ostensibly investigate Spock's murder. And it's Kirk, Picard, Bones, Scotty. We've also got Dr. Crusher and Geordi. And Kirk's son, Joseph, who we'll get to in a little bit here. And unbeknownst to Kirk, Captain Janeway's EMH, so the doctor from Voyager, is along as kind of Janeway's personal representative on this mission, because it's not just Spock's murder they're investigating. There's also some sort of clandestine mission going on that Picard is undertaking on behalf of Janeway as well. And of course, they're keeping this secret from Kirk because, you know, in these Shatnerverse novels, it's got to be Kirk versus the world. And, you know, everyone's out to malign and sideline Kirk. And it's up to him to save the day and all that kind of stuff. He's like the Jack Bauer, right, you know, of the Star Trek universe. He's got to go up against everyone and against all odds, yada, yada, yada. Anyway.
Yeah, and you mentioned about Janeway. And one of the things I liked about the book is we got, you know, quite a few scenes of Admiral Janeway in this and her relationship in managing Riker of the Titan and Picard and Kirk, and just seeing that relationship that we haven't seen that much of Janeway as an admiral with these characters. We've seen Admiral Janeway a lot in the Voyager novels, but to see her command and execute the mission with these crew of people was really nice to see, because we so many times we see the badmiral mm-hmm. or the admiral that's really making bad decisions. And not that they saw eye to eye or agreed with one another between Janeway and especially Riker, but you know, it wasn't like she was unreasonable.
Yeah, that's true. I have some issues with this plan that they're undertaking, which we'll get to later. But yeah, for the most part, like you said, she's not a badmiral. It's kind of interesting to explore that type of character, kind of like how the later Star Trek novels have with the character of Admiral Riker, you know, where he's kind of in that role. So yeah, I like that we get a main character thrust into that position that would usually be kind of an antagonistic role in like the TNG series or something like that. But, you know, it's a different relationship now. And I mean, it is kind of an antagonistic role in mm-hmm. some ways. Like you said, they don't always see eye to eye, but you know, it's a different relationship than, you know, Admiral Nechayev coming on board and dictating to Picard, or, you know, Admiral Pressman and his illegal cloaking device stuff. It's different.
Well, and one thing I want to point out about this novel, again, published in 2003, this was about a year after Star Trek Nemesis was in the theaters. And there's a lot of influence from that movie in this book. And one of the things is having Captain Riker and Troy aboard the Titan. And I think this is the first Star Trek book that featured him as captain of the Titan, because Taking Wing, which is the first dedicated Titan book, didn't come out until 2005.
Nice. Look at you doing all the research there. That's great. Because I was about to ask, when did Taking Wing come out? And that's interesting that this is the first we see of Riker in command.
Right. And we don't really see, we're not introduced to the crew and such, which I think is smart because that leaves the door open for the later novels to establish them.
Yeah. And that was really cool. I have to wonder if there was maybe a couple scenes with some crew or something like that. And, you know, the editors at Pocketbook said, oh, wait, actually, you know, we've got this plan to do this. Maybe you don't want to do that to leave those doors open. I'm wondering because, yeah, I would have thought they would have at least solicited, had pitches by authors by this time of what was going to happen with.
Yeah, Riker they may have the said, you know, don't go there or take those out. But there aren't many scenes aboard the Titan. So we don't really need that.
All we see is Riker and Troy aboard the ship.
Yeah, so they're the only two that operate the Titan. That's canon.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. Well, like you said, this book takes a lot of cues from Star Trek Nemesis. And one of the things that I thought Star Trek Nemesis kind of fell down on was the Riemans and kind of explaining that whole society. So, for example, watching Nemesis, I was never really sure if the Riemans were native to the planet Remus and were then enslaved by the Vulcans who came and became the Romulans, or if they themselves were descended from the Vulcan-Romulan split. And this book kind of takes the tack that they were also descended from Vulcans and have evolved from their time being in the dark on Remus to look the way they are. What do you think of how the Riemans were portrayed in this novel and kind of how that part of their society is shown?
When Nemesis came out, I thought that they may have been descendants of the Romulans, and because they were on Remus and maybe I'm remembering wrong, and maybe I'm thinking about this book and it's affecting my memory of that. But I've always kind of had that in the back of my mind when I think of the Riemans. So maybe it came from this book. I don't know. I don't remember anymore. But it wasn't surprising to me because that's how I always thought of them, as being descendants. So anyway, they're on Remus. And I just thought it was interesting how this book portrayed that anybody is a Rieman as long as they've been sent to Remus. So it's not necessarily this race. You don't have to be a descendant of the Romulans to be a Rieman, which so plays into other things that we get with Nemesis, including a clone of Picard.
Yeah, I actually have to applaud this book for kind of retconning that idea into the Rieman society, because that was brilliant. Like, that was one thing in Nemesis I never really understood, was they were like, oh, the new praetor of the Romulan Empire, and he's Rieman. And they're like, Rieman, my goodness. Oh, that's amazing. And they get there and he's a clone of Picard who was sent to Remus as a boy. But this idea that Rieman society is, if you're exiled to Remus, you're a Rieman. I love that. I thought that was just really nice. And I mean, you can read into Nemesis and say, oh, okay, that must be the case. But it's outright kind of retconned here that that's how it is. So even the Romulan guards kind of thing that are there are, if you're there long enough, you're almost exiled there yourself, because nobody really wants to do that. So they're kind of considered Riemans as well, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, so there's actual Romulans that are Riemans. So, and yeah, it totally explains why Shinzon is accepted and they're following his lead on a nemesis because they don't see him as being any different. It's almost like the Riemans think like the Federation. Doesn't matter what race you are, what species you are, you're part of the whole organization treated equal as long as you're here.
Yeah, it's treated more as a nationality than a species. So, yeah, which is interesting. Something you don't see a lot in Star Trek. Star Trek tends to, with the exception of the Federation, very much, you know, if you're a Betazoid, you're from Beta Z. If you're, you know what I mean? Like, it's very segregated, is the wrong word, but it's very species delineated, I guess. You know, if you wouldn't expect to see a non-Klingon as part of the Klingon Empire, for example.
No, absolutely.
But in this case...
No, that's a very good point. Yeah. We don't see that enough in Star Trek. It's... I feel as Star Trek continues on and evolves, whether it's in the books or even now on screen with Discovery, you know, we talk about the Klingons looking different in Discovery than other Klingons, and I really enjoy seeing different aspects. Like, you know, not everybody looks exactly the same that's part of the same species, and not everyone who is part of that society or that nationality has to be of that same species. You know, I mean, you could be a human and you grow up on Kronos and you're a Klingon because you grew up on Kronos, or maybe you're called a Kronosian. I don't know.
Well, speaking of not strictly delineated by species, let's talk a little bit about Kirk's son, Joseph, who, of course, is Kirk's son with Teylani, who is part Klingon and part Romulan. And the last time we saw him, he had been just been born and was kind of there was some genetic abnormalities with him, and he seemed a little outside of what would be considered the norm. And now we see him, he's, I think they said 5 or 6 years
old. 5 years
old at this point, but yeah, but kind of presents more like a 10 or 11-year-old or something like that.
Yeah, like Alexander.
Now this is, yeah, exactly. You know, you want to hire the young, the older actors,
or what we learned
more
in
quickly. So, I mean, Klingons
age
faster.
Well,
no,
it's all going back to the final reflection. That's where we learned that they grow
exactly.
up really quick.
Well, so yeah, Kirk's son, Joseph, really interesting character. And since you brought up Discovery, I want to ask if the same thing that went through your head that went through mine, they talk a lot about him being bald and having, you know, a ridged head and all this sort of stuff. I pictured kind of an amalgam of the Discovery style Klingons when they were describing him. And I mean, obviously that's just total coincidence. There's no link between that whatsoever, but it's really interesting that the descriptions kind of work with that. And I was kind of doing a meld in my head because he's got pointed ears of Romulan, but forehead ridges of a Klingon, and he's bald. I don't know. How about you? Did that enter your mind
at
all?
Now that you mention it, I do remember thinking that, because when they described his head and seeing the ridges or the spine from the back coming up to the back of his head, because I think, didn't they mention you saw like the spine of his back? I definitely pictured the Discovery Klingons in this. And you're right. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, part Romulan, he's part Vulcan, he's part human. He's got all these things going on. So it's like you take from, like what you're saying, take from Discovery what you saw and put pointed ears. And yeah, it's almost kind of hard to picture. I almost picture him like what we saw the Klingons even in the Discovery comics. Because we saw some younger Klingons in there. So I was kind of picturing that.
Yeah, that was kind of the young T'Kuvma and that kind of kid face, but with the Discovery style Klingon. Yeah. This is a really interesting character. He's Kirk's son, but could also, depending on how he develops, be considered Kirk's daughter at some point, because there's some, fluidity there, I guess. and he's got kind of some feminine names from his mother's side, Tikal and Talan. So a really interesting character, and also plays a big role, we find out in the story, possibly in Riemann Society, which when we kind of blow the spoiler horn and say we're going to be doing spoilers, we'll get a little bit more into that. Actually, this might be a good time to do that now, I think. So warning everyone out there, if you haven't read this book, you might want to pause the podcast, go read it quickly, come back, listen. Or if you don't care, just keep on listening. That's totally fine. But we're going to be getting into spoilers now, so consider yourselves warned. So they get to Romulan space, and they're intercepted by some warbirds. And it turns out that they want the ship diverted to Remus before they go to Romulus. And their interest seems to be in Kirk's son, Joseph. And it turns out that he is prophesized in Riemann Society as the one who will set them free and give them
their freedom. We're talking about Tom and Balana's baby? Oh, no.
Yeah, what is it with characters having messianic children?
Oh,
mate,
we're talking about Sisko and Cassidy's kid. No.
That must be it.
There is a lot of this in these books. I was like, why do we keep getting this?
Is the Traveler going to show up and say this kid's special and whisk him off to another plane of existence or something? Like, what's going on here?
That kind of bothered me, even though I think this is before some of those others. But, it was just like, why is every Starfleet officer has a kid and they're special?
Huh. I never thought about that. Jake must be really mad because he's just a writer. Not that there's anything wrong with writers.
No, not at all, because we're reading what they write.
Exactly. But yeah, so he's prophesized to be this great figure in Riemann society. And another thing we learn about the Riemanns is their names all come from what position they hold or what job they hold. So there's a Riemann, for example, named Doctor, and he's the Doctor there. And the title they give for the leader who will lead them to freedom is Shinzon. Yes. So apparently Shinzon's name wasn't just his name, it was his title as well. And that's a bit of a retcon as well, I'm thinking. But Joseph is apparently prophesized to be the new Shinzon for the Riemanns, which odd position to put a 5-year-old in,
yes,
I think.
Yes, but the prophecy says. But you know, I love this part, like you're saying about the titles, because Shinzon means liberator. And so the Shinzon we see in Nemesis, Shinzon now, I understand, wouldn't be his real name. And I don't think we really know what his real name is, except for maybe Jean-Luc Picard, because he's a clone of. But he took on that title of Shinzon because that's what they do on Remus. And they named them of, what it is that they do. And they recognized him as being their liberator. And now they're recognizing Joseph as being their liberator, which is also kind of interesting. Now I'm thinking about it, because the two Shinzons or two liberators are both a clone or a descendant of a Starfleet captain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's really a Picard and a Kirk. So the next one's going to be Sisko. He's going to be the new Shinzon emissary.
Well, I got to say, Kirk is just horning in on all the captain's territory, because in the last novel, he was like, he knew Bajoran religion and became just an expert and kind of revered by the Bajorans, in at least in this one little area, because of what he did. And in this one, he's like, Picard's clone was Shinzon. Well, my son is Shinzon too. So it's like, you can't have all these toys. I want to play with them myself, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, Kirk introduces himself from now on. James T. Kirk, father of Shinzon.
And also, I led my ship home from the Delta Quadrant twice.
That is true, too. Yes.
He's got to do it all.
Yeah.
So the fact of Joseph being this new Shinzon to the Riemanns kind of puts a huge monkey wrench in their mission, because they're waylaid from being able to go to Romulus to investigate Spock's death and instead have to deal with the situation on Remus. and are stuck there. But it's kind of good because all roads kind of lead to Remus here, because all of the plots seem to be centering around Remus. And there's this plot to start a new civil war, basically. And supposedly it's the Tal Shiar who are behind this plot. But we eventually learn that that is not the case. And the big baddies, who just happened to be talked about by Kirk and Picard in the last novel, and Kirk met very early in his mission on the original Enterprise, they're behind everything here. So we get a return of Norinda, who is this alluring, very attractive woman who can kind of change herself to be whatever someone desires, kind of thing. So, for example, she appears to Geordi as Dr. Leah yes. Brahms. I mean, Geordi, good Lord, the real thing, you've got the hologram version of her, and now you've got the Norinda version of her. Just, you know, make sure that Leah doesn't find out about this one, because she did not react well to the hologram. I don't think she'll react well to this. And Picard, she appears to him as Janice Manheim, this early girlfriend of his that was mentioned in season one of TNG. But they find out that pain can kind of drive her effect from their minds. So that's kind of how they get around that. And of course she appears to Kirk as Teylani. But Kirk doesn't even need to have some sort of external pain afflicted upon him, because he carries his pain with him. He needs his pain. Exactly. He knew exactly where I was going with that. And because of the death of Teylani, he carries his pain with him and is immune to that effect. So, yeah. Like you said, this is where we start to see those tie-ins with the last novel. Somewhat coincidentally, but whatever. I'll let this go eventually, I swear.
You know, I was just thinking, I wonder, because we never saw Riker see her. So how do you think she would appear to Riker? I have my answer. I'm just curious. I don't think it's Troy, though.
Uh-oh. Yeah, I was going to say, you better hope it's Troy if I think she's it's there. Because. Ooh, yeah, because Future Imperfect, yeah. Right? That was his...
And then Troy's standing there and she's like, bride. Will, what are you doing? But no, I...
you know, I think, just to go on a little tangent, I think Troy knows what she's getting into with Will Riker. And she just roll her eyes and go, yeah, I figured.
Yeah.
Troy's strong. She knows Riker.
She'll be like, that's okay, because... I would see Fabio, but or something like that.
Or Devanani Rall. Oh, God. Never mind. I hate that character.
But Norinda, I thought she was a bit cheesy in Captain's Peril, but I actually enjoyed her more in this. She does seem kind of over-the-top villain, in a sense. You know?
A little bit, yeah.
I like this in here. Just because of her effect on the others, and they know what she's doing, and they're trying to avoid, you know, trying to fall under her spell. And then her interactions with Joseph. And Kirk does not want Joseph to see her as his deceased mother, Teylani, and tells him to look away and don't look and don't look. And I enjoyed that scene. That was... For what this character is, that was probably the most powerful scene, at least somewhat emotionally, throughout the book involving Norinda. So I did enjoy that part of it.
Yeah, there are definitely times where she seems very over the top. And like, I was not buying her innocent routine before she's revealed as the big bad guy. You know, as Joseph says, she's a bad guy. I was not buying her kind of protestations of innocence and wanting everybody to love and that sort of thing. when in fact she is actually the representation of the totality. So in Captain's Peril, she tells Kirk that she's fighting the totality and, you know, wants their help in fighting them. But it's revealed here that she is actually what's behind it all. And the totality apparently is responsible for the fate of the Andromeda Galaxy, which was that whole bit that we saw at the end of Captain's Peril that kind of leads into this novel. So overall, what do you think, like, what's their end game here? Because they have this thing where they kind of dissolve things into matter or something like that. Is that what they're trying to do to the whole galaxy or something? Or, like, she's trying to start a war, but, like, what's the end game? What's she trying to do? And, I mean, I guess you probably know because you've read the next book.
Ooh, that's why I like rereading these, because I don't remember. And of course, as I start reading the next book, I'll go, oh yeah, now I'm starting to remember these things. But right now I don't, and it's not really revealed in here. It's almost just portrayed as if, you know, trying to take over the galaxy. You know, like, okay, trying to take over the galaxy, we must stop her from doing it. But I don't really know what the motivation behind that is. She talks so much about love, and it was almost like, you know, if you don't accept love, then you must be destroyed, in a sense. So I guess she's finding out that there isn't, like, a lot of love going on, and she's trying to identify who can love and who doesn't. I don't know.
She's like the really jilted, jealous ex-girlfriend or boyfriend.
I guess so.
If you don't accept me, I've got to destroy your life, I guess. I don't know. Like,
such an innocence to it, though, to me. It's like, she's very much like,
yeah, almost like a tantrum.
Well, yeah, it's like, you know, oh, you know, love me or feel love, and oh, you're not always feeling love. Okay, well then I guess I'll just have to destroy you because you don't love. I'll find something else. Like, I don't know. It just seems so la-di-da-da.
I'm wondering if there's a bit of a parallel here that, like, maybe there's a lack of understanding of what real love is. Because we get a scene earlier where they're talking to, I think it's Bones and Kirk are talking to Ahriman, where, you know, what will the Shinzon bring? And he says, oh, he will bring freedom. He said, well, what is freedom? What does that mean? And he kind of is like, I don't really know. Like, it will, our lives will be better. Well, how will they be better? Well, they just will, you know. And I wonder if, you know, in the way that, you know, and that's very tragic. An entire society of people who don't even understand what freedom is. They just know that it's something good. I'm wondering if there's kind of a bit of a parallel there with Narinda and the totality not knowing what love is.
That's very good.
You know, they just need a certain song sung to them. I want to know what love is. Something like that. Anyway, there you go. That's all you're going to get out of me.
I was just waiting
that.
For that. I watched you hesitate, like, am I going to do this? And boom, you went there. I loved it.
I was channeling Matthew Rushing, I think. Yeah.
Well, no, and I love what you said there. I think there is a parallel between those two. And it is tragic that they want freedom, but they don't really know what that is. So they're trying to obtain something they don't really understand because they've never experienced it. They just know it's good. I would love to see that played out more. I don't know if it, I don't recall if it does in the book, the next book. I don't think it does, but I mean, that's an interesting story right there in itself, in my opinion. What I did like also about this that was a bit comical was when she's trying to take Joseph away. And she's on that ship, the Q-tip. What's it called again? The
the Calypso.
Yes. She's trying to get him off the ship, and she says, "You know, come with me." And he's like, "Oh, Daddy, don't you know, I don't want to go, you know, and it's so good to see you because, you know, I was hiding and this is where I was hiding and this is what I was doing and giving like this whole like plan. And I'm like, wait, this sounds like he's like trying to tell Kirk not what he was doing, but what the plan was. And then I realized, oh, I know who this is. This isn't really Joseph. It's the doctor. It's the EMH. As Joseph.
that was a really cool ploy. And I have to ask, so did you realize that before they revealed it outright in the book? Or yeah, me too. Okay, cool. Like, and I thought it was really well done. Like, it was just enough when Kirk realizes it. He doesn't say it in the book in his mind or anything. He just says, oh, and then a switch turned on. He's like, yeah, you can go with it with her, blah, blah, blah. And it was at that moment too. I was like, oh, of course, that's what's going on. And yeah, it was
and
really
I was
cool.
concerned later. And like you said, we're in spoilers, but I was concerned later because was it shot? I think he shot and it was his emitter that fell and got hit or whatever. And then we never heard about him again. And I was getting to the end of the book when everything was wrapping up. I'm like, what happened to the doctor? Is he alive? And we're like, what happened? And then they finally said, oh, look, we fixed his emitter and he's fine now. You know, I was like, oh, good.
I feel bad because I didn't even think about it till it got to that part. And I was like, oh, yeah, right. Whoops. I would be a bad person to accompany the doctor on an away mission, apparently. I was like, oh, right. He was with us. I totally forgot.
Yeah, I'm a good person. I missed him. I was worried about him.
Well, good for you.
Because we don't get a lot of Voyager characters in these books, so, you know. Which we don't get any DS9
No,
characters,
that's true. So. No, but we got an interesting mix of TOS and TNG characters, which is kind of the final thing I noticed you put here on the outline here. This kind of meld of the two crews. So Kirk, Spock, and Bones, of course, from TOS and Scotty as well. And then from TNG, we've got Picard, Crusher, LaForge. And I forgot to mention Worf also shows up. And then Riker and Troy come by later from the Titan. How well do you think these guys all work together? Was this a good team or... What did you think?
So the reason I put this in the notes is because in the Shatnerverse novels, there seems to be a lot of melding of different crews and they just happen to fall in together. And sometimes they feel like it's forced. And in this case, it didn't feel as forced to me. It felt like, you know, we know that Riker and the Titan with Troy, of course, are in the near Romulus. Anyway, so, and that was established in Nemesis. So it made sense for them to be there. And it made sense for Janeway to be the admiral overseeing this mission who recruits Kirk to come find Spock, who, you know, find his murderer.
Right, because she sent Picard to Romulus in Nemesis anyway. So obviously that's something inside her
and
purview,
the,
I guess.
Enterprise is under repair from the events of Nemesis. So Picard and some of his crew members are available, you know? So it all just...
Yeah. I really liked how they worked that in because, like, that's kind of serendipitous that that worked out that way. Yeah. You know, the Enterprise is still getting repaired from crashing
and
into
Picard
the Scimitar.
And Picard initially didn't want to go, but Janeway convinces him to go on this mission. And the EMH, the doctor, you know, he's working for Janeway and he's secret agent EMH in this case, you know. So that's why I put it in here, because I felt out of the other Shatnerverse novels that brings a lot of these crews together, I felt this one felt not as forced and more natural. I think the other one, I think the return, that novel, that's the second one of the Shatnerverse, works pretty well, but I think this one works the best. So I really like that. Yeah. And when I put these in the notes, I try to give like fun titles and I called this one, "We Are One Big Happy Fleet" from Khan.
I like that because you totally hear Khan's voice there. It's like one of those memes that, you know, has a certain character in the text. And it's like, you totally heard this in their voice. Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, no, I really liked that. I guess the doctor, you know, has to say activate emergency super spy hologram or something like that. I don't know. But I have to say, I kind of liked the doctor in this one because there's an episode of Voyager, and I think it's actually like the second last episode of the series. It's called Renaissance Man. And you see the doctor doing things that you think like, the doctor should be able to do that. Like he disguises himself as crew members and Tuvok's trying to capture him and he like runs up the wall and flips over or something like that. And I'm like, that's the doctor I want to see. And in this book, he does a bunch of things like alters his hologram to make it look like he beamed away or Joseph beamed away or something like that. And just all sorts of little stuff that like that, that I'm like, yeah, the EMH should totally be able to do that. I thought that was a really interesting aspect.
Now, Matt should mention it. I would love to see a story, an adventure of the Doctor and Odo together because they can change their appearance throughout the whole mission.
And spend the entire time getting on each other's nerves. You imagine two grumpier characters together.
Gotta throw Quark into that whole mix just to make it interesting.
Oh man. Okay, I actually really want to read that now.
It's Excellent. The Doctor and Odo on a mission to save Quark and Neelix together.
I changed my mind.
And Quark is pouring the drinks and Neelix is making the food.
Okay. Yeah, no, I'm soured on the idea now. Well, putting that particular novel concept aside, what did we think about this novel? What are kind of your final thoughts and maybe a rating for Captain's Blood?
I like this novel a lot better than I like Captain's Peril, which is funny because they're both written by the same authors. Yeah, Captain's Peril was a disappointment, but Captain's Blood really came back strong. I still don't know if I like it as much as some of the other Shatnerverse books, but I did enjoy it. Like I said, with the different characters from the different series, I thought that flowed well. I like exploring Kirk as a father with Joseph, and bringing Kirk and Spock and McCoy together, and the totality was interesting and wasn't as goofy and silly as I thought she was in the first of this trilogy. So I really did like this book. So I say I give this book not a full amount of love, but so much love that it's enough to fill the world, but not quite totally.
Is it enough to buy the world a Coke?
Yes.
That's not bad.
Because before I got into this book, I wanted to know what love is.
Well, I want you to show me.
I'll pass on that.
Okay, yeah, probably for the best. I think I agree with a lot of what you said. It's a lot better than Captain's Peril. It's kind of one of those things when I start to read a Shatnerverse novel, I'm not that excited about reading it because, you know, I've been a little disappointed by some of them in the past. But, you know, once I got into this one, I really enjoyed the story. I thought it was really good. I loved Kirk and Bones, you know, making their way through these tunnels on Remus and their deception and getting into a shuttle and busting their way out and stuff like that. There's some really great parts in this book. The villain, I'm still not sold on her. I don't really know what her end game and motivation really is. I think it's a little unclear, but I'm hoping, you know, that kind of gets sorted in the next book and we've kind of figured those things out. But yeah, like I say, you know, on the face of it, a Shatnerverse novel doesn't excite me, but once you open it up, it surprises you. So I'm going to give this one Starfleet Q ship that looks like an old rust bucket. But once you figure out what it's really made of, it's actually pretty cool.
Oh my gosh, that is so good. That was such a good one. My love of the world with whatever in the Coke just sucks compared to how you just reviewed that. That was the perfect one.
I liked your rating. Well, I thought it was very good.
Thank you for all the love. Well, Dan, I really enjoyed hearing you saying that you want to know what love is. That made the feature right there. And I like also what you said about the Shatnerverse. You don't get really that excited about them, but you enjoy them typically when you do start reading them. I will say that I typically have always been excited about reading the Shatnerverse books because I've really thought in some ways they're a little over the top, but it's just fun to see Kirk playing in the 24th century and Judith and Garfield Reeves Stevens, who co-wrote this book with William Shatner. They always do an excellent job, and we know about so many of their books, and then they later worked on Enterprise, the series. So they don't necessarily always fit into the continuity as some of the other novels. They kind of stay on their own. That's why they're called Shatnerverse, but I always find them to be fun.
Yeah, there's definitely a fun aspect to them. I kind of had the thought halfway through reading this one that, like, the Shatnerverse novels are almost like fiction writers in the 24th century writing a book. Like, what if Kirk were alive today? And, like, writing, it's like fiction set in the Star Trek universe. Which, I mean, I guess it is. But you know what I mean? Like, it's like in-universe fiction that's been written by someone who lives in the Star Trek universe.
It's almost like you could see this book sitting on Captain Georgiou's shelf.
Totally.
Among her other books from the original series that haven't happened yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Some sort of temporal anomaly library she goes to yes. to get those books.
And those who are scratching their heads going like, what is he talking about? In Discovery, when she's on the Shinju, she's got books behind her desk on a shelf and you can't see them clearly, but the books are titles from original series episodes. So
one of those really cool Easter eggs that I just love. But anachronistic novels from outside the space-time continuum are not the only thing that we've been discussing on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Literary Treks.
But let's start with that first one, that Siege in Superspace. So, oh boy. Superspace, I don't know, is this better than subspace? Is it...
Well, I think it is. The thing I really love about this issue is we haven't had many stories at all about super space.
The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
Right. So, okay, they're under orders. They're not supposed to talk about it, and that's how you maintain the continuity that Kirk and Spock are surprised that there's a mirror universe. I mean, that works. That makes sense. But these people were there. They know that there's doppelgangers there because they know that because Cadet Tilly became Captain Killy, right? They know this.
To the journey!
There was a lot of face melting in this episode. You're right.
Everyone's melting. What a world! What a world!
It was, yeah, and everybody was slimy looking. Why were they so sweaty? Why?
Seven of Nine had this full-on Borg Queen look about her.
She did, and who else was really sweaty looking besides Seven?
Neelix was really sweaty looking.
Yeah, I thought he was.
And he had kind of a silver tone. He had the silver
blood.
He did.
Like, he was distinguished. Distinguished melting Neelix.
Yes. Like, yeah, he got a buff and polish.
The 602 Club.
No, I mean, it was really all we had was like animated shows. Like, you had like the animated Batman series, the animated Superman series. And as far as the big screen went, it was... not so great. I mean, you had Blade. Blade was... Some people cite Blade as kind of the precursor for the superhero genre picking back up, but it was very much kind of a genre film. I know technically it is a comic book film. I don't know if I'd count it in the realm of, like, big-budget superhero movies.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app. to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. You know, that desktop iTunes app, it seems like every time I go to it, it tells me to update. It drives me crazy. But anyway, if you get into there and then you, you know, update the app, then leave us a star rating and written review. We'd really appreciate it. It helps people find us here on the network or out in the podcast universe. And if you're not an Apple user, well, that's fine. So you can also find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can really help us out by becoming a patron of the network on Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all of the details. Perks can include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, and that's all available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce and distribute all of these shows each month, and we really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Once again, you'll find all of the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
And we would love, love to hear your thoughts, because this show is all about love. And so we'd love to hear your thoughts about today's show. And there are many ways you can do that. And the best place to join in on the larger conversation is the Babel Conference. It's our listeners group on Facebook. And you just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook and it should come right up. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that from our form on our website at trek.fm/contact. And just search, I mean, just send to a show and select Literary Treks, and then we'll see your email come straight to us. And you can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM.
And also special for the Literary Treks podcast, we have a Goodreads group where we have bookshelves with all of our previously covered books, as well as the currently reading section, so you know what's coming up in future episodes. Plus, there are great conversations happening about all the books and comics that make up the Star Trek universe. Just search for Literary Treks on Goodreads and click Join Group, and one of us will let you right in. We'd like to take this time to thank Norman C. Lau, Ken Tripp, Greg Rosier, Brandon Chamutala, Justin Ozer, and Jeffrey Harlan for their support of the Trek FM network, and specifically for being associate producers for Literary Treks. We really appreciate it, guys. Thank you so much. Now, Bruce, when you're not faking your death by detonating a live bomb while recording Literary Treks, just so that our listeners have that emotional tie that really keeps them strong and missing you on this podcast, where can we find you?
Well, you can find me trying to convince you that I did die in my fake death, but then in my second book, I will not convince you of that. So you can find me on Twitter at @Admiral_Rex, and you can find me talking Star Wars on the Star Wars Report podcast, and you can get that in all the same places we mentioned about where you can watch or find Trek FM shows to listen to. And you can always find me in the Babel Conference talking, typing, listening, and reading everything that's in there. Even though we don't talk and listen, it's typing and reading. But Dan, let me ask you, when you're not in the Babel Conference, no, when you are not on Remus, being the liberator she's on of the Remans, where can people find you?
Well, I mean, it's a big surprise. I didn't really expect this, and I'm really not sure what to do with that title. But when I'm not dealing with all of that, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Kertrats. That's K-E-R-T-R-A-T-S. You can find me on YouTube at youtube.com/Kertrats Productions, where I make videos talking mostly about Star Trek, but also other science fiction. And you can find me on facebook.com/Kertrats Productions, and of course on Facebook in the Babel Conference as well. Well, thank you everyone so much for listening, and until next time,
live long
and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.